Some of my most magical moments have been lost in the countryside of England, immersed in its mysterious, misty, ancient history, prehistoric. Heavy, coarse grass, soggy bogs, misty bluffs, long-haired ragamuffin sheep, following my battered old ordnance survey map that I borrowed from the bed and breakfast. Then I reach my destination. It's my own private stone circle. After Stonehenge, with all the barbed wire and tour groups and portaloos and the tour guides with their blowhorns, this was really evocative. A circle of lichen and moss-covered stones put there, you know, to function as a celestial calendar by mysterious people 5,000 years ago. I could be in countless places all around Britain, but this was Gidley in Dartmoor, sampling England's prehistoric wonders. We're going to talk right now about prehistoric England, and I'm joined by a tour guide friend of mine from Dartmoor, Roy Nichols. Roy, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Rick.
When I talked about that experience walking through a moorland and coming upon my own private Stonehenge, can you relate?
Oh, certainly. Many of these stone circles and the individual standing stones are in remote places. They were built in remote places in the first place, often away from agricultural land. So it's an experience you can have in many places in Britain.
There's a lot of history before Henry VIII.
Oh, heavens above. I mean, we're talking thousands of years.
But if we think of the pyramids in Egypt, same things have lots of going on in England.
Well, exactly. You know, the same sort of time period, 2,000, 3,000 BC.
So when you travel around England, it's really like an open-air folk museum to these stone remnants of those civilizations that we really don't know much about.
Well, it's certainly one of the more mysterious periods of history. From about 4,000 BC, when agriculture had been introduced to the British Isles, people started to make and build monuments, be it burial mounds or henge monuments or standing stones or stone circles. For something like 2,500 years, they were building these monuments all over the British Isles.
So let's talk about Stonehenge, the most famous of these stone remnants of England's mysterious past. First of all, this goes back to the times of the pharaohs, 3,000 BC or so, built by people we don't know much about. Most people think it was a celestial calendar. In your estimate, who made these and why?
We know who made them. Not individuals, of course, but the people, the culture that created them. They were some of the first agriculturalists in Britain. For some reason, perhaps part of their culture, they were trying to mark and define celestial movements. They were lunar calendars, solar calendars, places of worship.
Related to their planting and their harvesting.
Certainly that was one of the roles, not entire role, but nonetheless, that was one of the facets, one of its uses, that they could actually mark the seasons. But that was an integral part of their ritual and religious services, I don't doubt.
So when civilization reaches the point where people are settling down and becoming farmers instead of, scavengers or whatever, then they've got the wherewithal to coordinate and the need to have something like a big celestial calendar.
Exactly. And whether the use of agriculture was a catalyst for the building of these or whether these were a result of agriculture, we don't really know what came first.
But there is a sort of indication that it was lined up with where the sun rises and
sets.
Oh,
yes. All of these stones have some purpose like that, but it's one of the facets of it. I don't think it's the sole purpose.
No, but I mean, to this day, Druids gather on the summer solstice and
they do.
Dance
around. The sort of modern Druids who were really sort of come about in from the 19th century onwards have adopted places like Stonehenge and Avebury. But do remember the Druids were the priests of our Celtic ancestors who came something like 2,000 years, 1,500, 2,000 years after our ancestors built these sites.
Now, we can envision Stonehenge, these huge stones. And even the biggest stones of Stonehenge, like 20 tons each, were brought from, 10 or 20 miles away. But the blue stones, these are several tons each, were carried from Wales.
That's right. They're smaller, some in the region of about 6 tons.
And but that's 100 miles away?
120 miles away, the Preseli Mountains in South Wales.
And there's no doubt these stones had to come from South Wales.
Oh, yes, they've traced the very spots where
they
came from.
There's no way they could come from anywhere else. So they had to transport these 5 or 6 ton stones 120 miles. How on earth did they do that in the time of the
pharaohs? We have to acknowledge and appreciate the skills of our ancestors. They had a good understanding of mechanics. Using no metal tools, they brought these stones overland and by river, 120 miles, using sledges, rafts, and then using levers to actually get them into place.
Now, that's the boring engineer's take. What about ley lines?
Well, there's a great controversy, and archaeologists don't really acknowledge them, don't really acknowledge the existence of ley lines, but they are supposed lines lines of power that connect places of importance from our prehistoric times.
So if you're a New Agey type that's inclined to believe this, you can take all the Stonehenge-type stuff in England, line them up, and they do make a grid of lines.
It was all of this really was first popularized by a chap called Alfred Watkins about 100 years ago, just over 100 years ago. And he wrote a book called The Old Straight Track. And he was the first one that noticed that many of these prehistoric sites and later sites are actually connected by old trackways. He was the first one to really start connecting these imaginary lines across the countryside.
So conceivably, if there were these ley lines and these special places built along these ley lines where two ley lines would intersect is quite an exciting spot.
That's right. And in fact, places like Glastonbury Tor in Somerset, there are many, many lines actually connecting there.
So whatever the case is, all over England you can find stone circles and remnants from this era.
Oh, certainly. I mean, there isn't a place. There are concentration areas, but nonetheless, they're everywhere.
What's your favourite stone circle?
Well, I do like Avebury as one of the larger circles because of its role of its importance. But nonetheless, I do like some of the small local ones that we have. Places like Gidley and Dartmoor or Castlerigg Stone Circle near Keswick in the Lake District.
Mm, I love Castlerigg at sunset.
It's a romantic, beautiful setting.
On the drive into Keswick from the motorway.
That's right.
That's right. Now, if you're thinking about England and mysterious remnants from its past, you've got these chalk figures that are carved under the hillside. You know, we think of the chalky cliffs of Dover, but all of South England really is sitting on chalk, isn't it?
Right. Until you get down into counties like Devon, you're actually sitting on chalk most of the time.
So you cut away the grass and the sod and a little bit of dirt.
It's a very simple process. The soil over the chalk is very shallow, often only about 12 inches or 18 inches deep. So once you cut out the turf, you're exposing the chalk underneath. So you can make any figure that you want very, very simply.
So what happened across South England?
It happened in lots of places. Many of the figures are horse figures. Many of those are later ones, but there are some very early ones.
The genuine prehistoric ones would be figures from the people's religion, I suppose. A horse must have had some sort of significance.
Well, it's thought that they represent, I mean, the horse has always been a figure from prehistoric times and later times. And it's thought that many of them are dedicated to the Celtic goddess Epona, whose symbol was the horse.
And these people were sophisticated enough to actually realize that it's on a slanted hill. It'll be seen from this perspective. They would stretch out the horse so that when you see it from a particular angle, it would look realistic.
That's right. Because if you just did it as it was, obviously, the angle of perspective would make it all out of shape.
That's quite sophisticated for people.
We had very sophisticated ancestors.
In what century would some of these genuine prehistoric horses be?
Well, the most famous of these white horses is Uffington in Berkshire. And that one is thought to date probably from about 2000.
2000 BC.
Yeah.
My goodness. And you have some big giants also. So I think the biggest man-made portrayal of a human being, arguably, is one of these chalk.
That's right.
Figures.
And the most famous of these is the one at Cernabis, or just outside the little village of Cernabis in Dorset. It's a huge figure, 370 feet high.
370 feet from head to toe?
Head to toe.
And he has a huge erection, doesn't he?
He does indeed. He's obviously a male figure, and a very excited male figure as well.
Now, this must have been for some sort of fertility concerns for the people that carved
there's no one opinion on the origins of this figure. But it is thought to have been a fertility symbol of some sort. And right through until quite recent times, the village maidens would spend the night on the penis to increase their fertility. And if they did get pregnant, it was one of the sort of extras.
Really? Now, wait a second. This guy is 360 feet tall. And with an erection, that's more than enough room for the maiden to actually spread out her sleeping bag.
Certainly, there's an attraction to it. I suspect if they did become pregnant, it had more to do with wandering shepherds than anything else. But
the wandering shepherds of, what's that guy's name? Cernabis.
Cernabis. Yeah.
Where is this giant in the south of England?
It's just north of the county town of Dorchester in Dorset.
Okay, so lots of exciting reasons to travel across the south of England. All over England, we find lots of Britannia, Londinium, Roman England.
Well, the Romans came to Britain finally in 43 AD, and they stayed for close to 400 years, and they left so many remains. Of course, we've got Hadrian's Wall, which is a great fortification in the north of England, but there's Roman remains all over England. A good indicator of a Roman settlement is either a prefix or a suffix, the word Chester.
Chester.
Or Cester. Exactly.
Cluster.
It comes from the Latin castra, meaning fort. It indicates either a military or civilian settlement.
And the Romans would make a straight road, right? Are there
they built something like 10,000 miles of road, originally really for the military to move troops around. And
10,000 miles across the empire or across Britain?
No, just in Britain itself.
Just in Britain?
Yes.
My goodness.
Not all of them were sort of major roads, with many local trackways and things. But
they had quite a presence, quite a determination to stay there. Constantine, the emperor, was actually in Britain for a time, wasn't
he? Oh, yes. There was something like three emperors actually crowned in Britain itself.
Now, this Constantine was in what city?
In York.
In York. So York was a Roman town.
Yeah. In the middle of the 4th century, the previous emperor died and he was declared emperor by his troops.
And this was during the fall of Rome, actually.
It was not actually during the fall of Rome, but it was very close towards the end of certainly the Roman presence in Britain and the fall of the sort of the main Roman power in Rome itself.
Because didn't Constantine get some kind of a letter or communique from headquarters say, you know, you're on your own, we're not going to support the Roman presence in Britain anymore?
Well, that came a little bit later. There was a famous sort of letter sent to the sort of chieftains of Britain. It's called, the chieftains of Britain actually sent a letter to the Roman authorities in Rome asking for help to protect the country. It's called The Groans of the Britons. And the Roman authorities wrote back and said, sorry, lads, you're on your own.
You're on your own. The Groans of Britain.
The Groans of the Britons.
What does the Roman presence in Britain have to do with King Arthur?
It's thought if Arthur did exist, and Arthur is mentioned in lots of old, sort of particularly Welsh texts, but it's thought that if Arthur did exist, he was of a period towards the end of the Roman Empire or towards sometime just after, perhaps of a Roman descent himself, but certainly of a Romanized people who was really trying to protect his way of life and his people during that period when the Anglo-Saxons were invading Britain.
So he would have been a champion of the Roman people or of the indigenous people?
Well, essentially, by that time, they were much in the same thing.
So the Romanized British people.
They were Romanized British Celts.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. I'm speaking with Roy Nichols about his countryside and its ancient heritage. Our phone number is 877-333-RICK. You can email us at radio@ricksteves.com. Rebecca's on the phone in Vidalia, Georgia. Rebecca, thanks for your call.
Thank you. I had made a trip to Cornwall. It was at the end of a two-month trip that started in Italy and ended in Cornwall. I went to visit my daughter's in-laws, and they took us to Tintagel. And I didn't know much about Tintagel, but we were so fortunate to see it as we walked down. There's very steep, it's right on the sea, and there's very steep steps going down to it, stone steps, and then this wonderful ruins of this ancient castle. And we were so fortunate because when we got there, the sea was just a beautiful blue, just bright and gorgeous. And as we were there, the rain came in, and the mist started rising up out of the water, and you just knew King Arthur was around the corner somewhere. It was just magical.
Now, so Tintagel, so people know Tintagel is on the northern coast of Cornwall, down in the west of England, southwest of England, mm-hmm. and it is mm-hmm. an evocative setting, and it's the legendary birthplace of King Arthur?
It is, yeah.
Right.
That's said to be the birthplace of King Arthur. Of course, there's many sites throughout the southwest and the southern England, places like Glastonbury, but yes, Tintagel was said to be where King Arthur was born.
Rebecca, I interrupt you. I'm sorry. Tell us more about your Tintagel experience.
Well, it was marvelous because we stayed in the rain. It wasn't so hard that we couldn't still be around, and we took wonderful pictures with the mist coming up from the rocks, up from the sea, and then there were bright colored flowers. It was in May that we took great pictures of against the stormy sea, and then the sun came out again, and we had a wonderful cream tea back up in the village. So it just was perfect.
That's such a holistic English experience, isn't it? A cream tea, King Arthur, beautiful, rugged coastline. You know, Donna in Elkin, North Carolina, emailed us, and she visited Merlin's Cave when the tide was out, and she found that very evocative, too, with lots of sea life on the walls of the cave and so on. Merlin's Cave is associated with Tintagel.
It is,
and we missed that. That's for next time.
Well, it's a sea cave that lies below the promontory on which Tintagel stands. And if the tide's right, obviously if it's low tide, you can actually walk down some steps, get onto the seashore, and walk just around the little corner into this great sea cave, and it's beautiful.
Now, Roy, what is the rationale for English people thinking that Tintagel would have been the birthplace of King Arthur?
Well, it's only really through legend. There are obviously no documents saying that that's where he was born, but all the legends indicate that if he did exist, that was where he was born. But he has connections throughout the southwest of Britain, southern Britain, but even as far north as Edinburgh.
And Rebecca, when you were in Tintagel, Tintagel, by the way, for people who are planning their English travels, did you find that the town itself was just a welcoming and easy place to sort of settle into?
Oh, very much so. We didn't stay. We were doing day trips out from Liscombe, which is where my family lived, but very easy to drive around in and to walk up the cliffs from the castle to a chapel that's up on the top, and it's a great place to walk around. And, of course, there's so many little fishing villages scattered all over that part of Cornwall that you need a car, but it's a delightful place to visit.
They were quite enthusiastic about their tourism and their association with King Arthur. I remember there's a pub in town called the
Excalibur.
The Excalibur.
Oh, right.
Is that still there, Roy?
I think it is. Yes. I haven't been for a couple of years.
Did you see it, Rebecca?
Yes, I remember seeing and several shops with some variation of that name.
The English have a wonderful way with their little shop titles and funny plays on words, the Excalibur. Rebecca, thanks for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Roy, there's so much history in medieval and ancient Britain. You got the Vikings actually coming into England.
Yeah, once the Roman Empire had fallen, the Roman presence in Britain had gone, you have a sort of vacuum, a cultural and political vacuum, and you have the beginnings of settlement from outside in other parts of Europe, beginning with the Anglo-Saxons, who started coming into Britain in the late 5th century through the 6th and 7th century. And then really from the sort of 9th century onwards, you've got the period of the Vikings.
From Denmark mostly were these Vikings or Norway?
From all over, Scandinavia.
And York was their capital, right?
Well, the Danish Vikings actually settled in York, and much of what we know of what we think of as Yorkshire today is settled by the Danish Vikings.
So that's like the 800s and the 900s, and then 1066 we've got?
The Normans coming in, and in fact the Normans, although they were sort of French politically and culturally by this stage, in fact their ancestors had been Vikings as well, and the very term Norman means Northman.
And when you travel around England today, you find the remnants of this, whether it's haunted walks or whether it's sort of creepy vibes for the Holy Grail and what's going on in Glastonbury, or whether it's visiting Roman ruins in the far north of England. When you go to Glastonbury, here you're finding 21st century appreciation of England's pagan past.
Yes, you're right. It really is a centre for the New Age beliefs. And so you get this traditional English market town, you know, rubbing shoulders with all the New Age beliefs and so many shops dedicated to crystals and all of those different aspects of that.
And this Holy Grail business and everything, there's some historical basis because Joseph of
Arimathea,
he came to England actually in the time of Christ.
Well, the legend says that sometime after the death of Christ, Joseph Arimathea with a band of followers brought Christianity to England, or what would become England, bringing with him the Holy Grail. And the Holy Grail was the vessel used at the Last Supper. And it's lost and buried somewhere in around Glastonbury.
Where?
If I knew that, I'd be very, very famous.
I'm Rick Steves. We're speaking with Roy Nichols about the wonders of ancient, prehistoric, and medieval Britain, the misty, deep past. Roy, if you're going to pick a single spot where you feel sort of the wonders of prehistoric Britain, where would that be?
I would still have to go to one of the great stone circles somewhere, particularly Avebury, because that's one of my favorites, I think.
And Avebury, an hour east of Bath. Wonderful side trip from Bath, by the way. Why Avebury instead of Stonehenge?
It's less touristy than Stonehenge. You have access to the whole site. You can actually wander through and round the stones. So it's much more evocative. It's a much more hands-on experience in every sense.
Roy Nichols, thank you very much for sharing your country's distant past.
It's been my pleasure.
Rick Steves teaches smart travel to England, Scotland, Ireland, and beyond. At ricksteves.com, you'll find an archive of interviews from his radio show, free audio tours, a monthly travel newsletter, and a world of information to help you turn your travel dreams into smooth and affordable reality. To gear up for your next adventure in Great Britain or Ireland, begin your trip at ricksteves.com.